The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, League Cup final. Liverpool get the Carabao in the can. Bye-bye Bielsa. Leeds give the legend his marching orders and prepare to take orders from March. We'll look back on the Premier League action from the weekend and ahead to the FA Cup fifth round, including non-league Boreham Wood's chances away at Everton. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. All right, Monday 28th of February, listener, and joining us in the pod today, we've got Daniel Story. Hello, Daniel.
Good morning, James.
Also with us, Natalie Jedra. Welcome back, Natalie, of ESPN Brazil.
Hello.
Lovely to see you again. And also here's Sasha Gurionov. Hey, Sasha.
Morning, James.
How are you doing?
Well, it's a bit mixed, isn't it? The world is very different, I think, from when it was only a few days ago. It's hard for me to articulate the frustration and bewilderment at what's happening, and it's just for me it's been quite hard to focus on the football, to be honest.
Mm. All three of you were at the League Cup final on Sunday at Wembley, no?
Yep,
we were.
Yeah, and
even though I didn't see Daniel, so I'm just trusting his word. Yeah.
Yeah, we just believe him. Yeah.
I mean, a big moment before, absolutely, as you say, Sasha, at the forefront of everybody's minds right now, the situation of the people of Ukraine as they suffer this invasion. And the Wembley crowd, was it the entire stadium joining in the chorus of You'll Never Walk Alone? Did that become a kind of neutral expression of solidarity or not entirely?
I don't
not entirely?
Think so.
I mean, by the Chelsea fans, I don't think it was. I think it was just the Liverpool end.
Okay.
But it was, I mean, I was reassured to see, I was slightly worried going to the game whether, you know, we know tribalism as it is. I was wondering whether we might get a kind of defence of Roman, which therefore becomes a kind of implicit defence of Russia almost from Chelsea fans. But there were loads of Ukraine flags in the Chelsea end, which was really reassuring. And although they didn't sing "You'll Never Walk Alone," that, you know, that doesn't reflect any lack of feeling on their part, don't you think?
Yeah, certainly You'll Never Walk Alone with Ukraine colours, banners and the like on display. Of course, scenes in so many places around football and in all walks of life in demonstration of solidarity with Ukraine. Eintracht Frankfurt with their stadium scoreboard, they put a pretty explicit "Stop it, Putin" message up ahead of the game with Bayern Munich, which is nice because you've seen a lot of calls for peace and very kind of ambivalent neutral reflections. You probably saw the moment when Roman Yaremchuk came on for Benfica against Vitória in Lisbon and the whole stadium gave him that standing ovation. What to make of, I mean, we should touch briefly on Chelsea, of course, featured in the League Cup final, and the announcement by Roman Abramovich that he was ceding control of the club to a trust for Chelsea's good, which I think was taken at face value by a lot of people, but a day or two on, not sure how much it actually means. Certainly privately, a lot of the trustees have said they have absolutely no intention of taking this up, talk of being used as a front and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like the equivalent of the kind of classic thoughts and prayers, in that there may be some good intention, but it doesn't actually count for a great deal in terms of legalese, and stewardship is and care are nothing without ownership, and they are nothing to do with ownership. It might be a gesture, and it might be a let's give the benefit of not much doubt, and it might be a very well-meaning gesture, but it does feel like an attempt to avoid Chelsea being involved in sanctions, which is an understandable move on Abramovich's part, but it doesn't mean anything. Mm. You know, you can't give someone stewardship. That isn't a thing.
The other major development in football terms is the position taken by various national FAs that they won't play Russia. Principally Poland, I think, were the first to announce this, who are due to be playing Russia in the World Cup qualifier playoffs. They've said they won't go ahead. Sweden, potential opponents of Russia further down the line, have also called themselves out, as have various nations, including England. No word that, FIFA actually, their position, Infantino, who refused to answer questions about whether he would return his Order of Friendship medal that he received from Vladimir Putin. FIFA's position is that Russia can continue to play games, but without flags being used or under a different flag and behind closed doors, which I mean, I don't think there's anyone listening to this who thinks that that's an adequate solution. I don't think anyone can countenance really how you would play football against a team representing a nation that's doing what Russia's currently doing. Sasha, would you agree with that?
I agree. And Poland and Sweden already said no to to whatever flag this team is going to come out under. But I think also historically, like looking at what FIFA have done in the past, I'm not sure what FIFA have done in the past on this. Because, for example, when Argentina invaded the Falklands in 1982, they still played in the World Cup. In 1974, I think this is the one that sort of the Russians are thinking of, Pinochet overthrew Allende when USSR was supposed to play Chile in the playoffs for the World Cup. They played the first leg in Moscow. It was 0-0. And I think before the second leg, the coup d'etat happened and the Soviet Union didn't travel. They boycotted Chile and Chile went to the World Cup. But then certainly you have examples of Yugoslavia, but that's within UEFA. Yugoslavia being thrown out in the early 90s. But as it stands, it's very difficult to see how Russian international sport can continue in current conditions. And I think this is something that I think a lot of people in Russia realize as well. And I think it's going to be sort of currently as things stand. Apparently today there's going to be discussion about whether Spartak Moscow can continue in Europa League.
Right.
Because they already have to play a neutral ground and probably soon they won't be able to fly to Germany. I mean, there's all these extra complications. I think also interestingly, you know, Daniel Farke went to work for Krasnodar. Krasnodar didn't play this weekend because Krasnodar Airport was closed for civilian use because of you know what. What's he going to do going forward? And there's Voronin at Dynamo Moscow who was given compassionate leave and the fans were chanting for him. And it makes Russian society question itself.
Right.
It makes people involved with Russia, I think, question themselves as to where they really stand.
Well, I think that's really interesting because whilst there is an impact of the war, the invasion on sport, I think obviously that's the least of the questions about the impact of what Russia's done in Ukraine. But the significance of this impact on sport and sport's reaction to it is perhaps greatest in its ability to get the message of what's happening in Ukraine back to Russia so that it is said, Sasha, and maybe you might have a better picture of this than us, that it is very hard for people in Russia to know what's going on in Ukraine, and perhaps through sport and through nations refusing to play Russia and all these other ramifications, that more truth will arrive.
Yeah, it's the sort of things that are more difficult to ignore when things aren't actually happening, like I don't know, football games and people, you know, would think, for what reason. For me personally, the situation, I mean, I've been to Kyiv a number of times. I love the place. I've got mates there, you know, obviously through all the football. One of my friends, I got him tickets to AC Milan when Liverpool played there in the way, and he went with his wife and his 10-year-old daughter. And I'm thinking of guys like him because, I mean, on Thursday when I was reading the news in the morning and I was taking my kids to school and to the nursery, and they were taking the kids to basements. And I'm like, it's just on the very personal level, I think it's just incomprehensible. And it's like, I mean, there was like a rocket that hit an apartment block, and I recognized it because you can see it from the window of my mates with whom I stayed during the 2018 Champions League final. And it's just all very close to the bone. And I think it's also very close to the bone for a lot of Russia because I don't know if people like appreciate outside of the part of the world, there's a lot of connection between Russia and Ukraine. It's two big populations. People have relatives on both sides of the border. And this is another thing as well, you know, in terms of information flow through official channels or through social media, you also have so many personal links, which you can't just cut. And, you know, people talk, people know that their relatives are trying to flee, some successfully, some not. I think in the modern age, the full picture, whilst it's difficult maybe to piece details together, the overall picture is pretty, pretty horrific. And I don't think this will escape anybody in the world, to be honest. And that includes Russia.
All right. Well, I'm sure a lot of people will wonder at the impact of the thoughts and prayers style reactions from a lot of football. But any impetus they can give to turning the tide on what's been happening in Ukraine, I think, has to be welcomed. Anyway, let's get on to the football and the Carabao Cup final.
Keeper against keeper. Oh! Liverpool win the Carabao Cup. Pepper's skied it. Chelsea have blown it.
Sunday afternoon at Wembley Stadium, Chelsea 0, Liverpool 0, but Liverpool winning the Carabao Cup 11-10 on penalties. You were all there for non-scoring 120 minutes, followed by the highest scoring shootout ever between two top-flight English teams. Natalie, did you enjoy the shootout?
Oh my God. Yeah, well, I think we all enjoyed everything. I think it was the most prolific new that I've seen in my life, with four goals but still new. And then the shootout, the quality of the penalties was outstanding. They were really going for it, and well, a lot of things impressed me in this great football match. But I think starting with Liverpool, what I find different in this Liverpool is that they seem much more mature without losing that edge, you know, because a couple of years ago or 3 years ago, if you compared this Liverpool to the other Liverpools who were fighting for championships, they just seemed like they had so much to lose at any point, you know, that edge that we really enjoy when watching Liverpool. But now they seem much more in control of their own actions, and they don't lose that intensity. They force some spectacular saves from Mendy, and I think we're going to get into the goalkeeping situation. They kind of look tired on extra time, but they still looked composed and managed to have a really good penalty shootout. So that aspect of Liverpool really stands out for me, not only yesterday, but during the whole season, how much they look mature, but at the same time intense, and they still have that edge.
God love football scriptwriters. Hey, Daniel. Kepa, infamous.
Yeah, and look, that was pre-planned. Edouard Mendy knew what was happening. Thomas Tuchel knew what was happening. Kepa knew what was happening. He started, you know, he started preparing to come on 3 or 4 minutes before he did, and it was kind of expected. Although we hadn't really considered that, you know, it would go to a penalty shootout when goals were being disallowed and posts were being hit and saves were being made throughout the 90 minutes. Personally, I think Tuchel got it wrong, which is incredible outcome by us on my part. Of course, it is. It's hindsight. But it isn't just that Kepa has a better penalty record at saving penalties than Edouard Mendy. There has to be some weighing up of the situation, in my opinion. And Mendy was the game's best player. Mendy won AFCON 3 weeks ago in a penalty shootout. So he knows what it takes. And he is, I think, probably the best goalkeeper in the world on current form, if not the best, certainly in the top three. And I think that makes a difference. I think if you're a Liverpool player stepping up and Edouard Mendy has made one incredible save, but two or three more brilliant saves, I think that makes a difference in your mind. I think it's easier to face him than Kepa.
Sasha, as a keeper yourself of some note, that's a really interesting point. But psychologically, there must be an extent to which you need to make saves to get your confidence up for a game. If you're Mendy and you've been through 90 minutes of pulling off spectacular saves, presumably you're going to be in a better mental state to face spot kicks than if you're Kepa, coming off the bench specifically for spot kicks, and therefore with all the pressure in the world on you, especially when you remember that you were the guy who refused to come off in an equivalent moment in 2019.
I think it's an interesting situation, because I think in terms of preparation, you know, they could have had Kepa focusing on penalties purely as opposed to Mendy. I think it's an interesting thing to do. It's certainly unusual and it's certainly risky, even if for Kepa's reputation, because his reputation as a penalty expert is now completely in tatters, because he didn't contribute and he lost the shootout for them in the end. I would say, though, one thing, and I'm going to go completely contrary to the narrative. I don't think Mendy is the best goalkeeper in the world. I think in this game, he tried very hard to give away two goals because of basic technical deficiencies. He's a big presence. I think he uses his size very well and pretty effectively, but the amazing double save in the first half should never have been a double save. And then in the second half, his missed kick let in Salah, and only Salah's poor finish prevented Liverpool from going a goal ahead. So I don't think when people look at Mendy, people think, oh my God, look, he's extraordinary. He's going to save everything. I don't think strikers should have it in their mind, because I don't think he's that brilliant. And I know most of the people in the world disagree with me. So when it comes to penalties, it's not, again, just necessary to be big like he is. I think it takes more than that. So maybe sort of the coaching staff do have good logical reason to put Kepa in. But I think the thing that broke Kepa in this particular shootout was the third penalty from Liverpool, when he basically left a third of the goal for Van Dijk, and he absolutely smashed it past him. And Van Dijk was there going, I've seen this with Van Dijk before. He has like moments of extreme competitiveness. And this one, he absolutely leathered it. And I think from that moment onwards, he just basically said to him, look,
he leathered it crucially to the same side.
Yeah, exactly. So he basically, he offered him the side and he just shot straight through him. And I thought at that stage, that Liverpool penalty takers, I thought, would prevail. But the problem was Kelleher wasn't saving anything either. So then you have to the stage where then Kepa needs to save Konate's penalty, and he should have saved Konate's penalty. He didn't. But yeah, interesting game of psychology. And no, I don't think Mendy's that great.
But I think you either start with Mendy and go with Mendy, or you start with Kepa. And I'm looking at the human side of it. You have Kepa that played the whole tournament. And on the other side, you have Kelleher who played the whole tournament. So Klopp is there benching Alisson, and Tuchel is playing Mendy. Of course, it was already arranged. They let's assume that they really did talk it through. And of course they did. But if you're Kepa, of course you're affected by it. You play the whole tournament. You're watching Liverpool in the same situation as you are, but they're benching their main goalkeeper. And then you play Mendy, and then it comes to the penalty shootout. It's not the same level of confidence. You're not going to get your player in the same level of confidence as you were if you started Kepa, or if you kept that decision. So I think it's he did that in the Super Cup and it worked, but it was a different context. It was just one match. It was the start of the season, but now you have a goalkeeper who was important during the whole campaign, and he's not playing the final, and you're only putting him for the penalty shootout. I think it has an effect.
I also think that the psychological advantage of those decisions, and the famous one is obviously Tim Krul in the World Cup. The advantage there was established because nobody knew it was coming, and it did spook Costa Rica's players. That psychological advantage is clearly lessened when, if you'd have asked me before the game, if Mendy starts, do you think Kepa will be on for penalties? I'd have probably said yes, because it happened exactly the same in the Super Cup, and that's how it goes. So Liverpool must have considered the option that Kepa would come on penalties, and if they were planning their penalties, if they were planning where to put them, where the keeper goes, his tells, then they would have done it for both goalkeepers, because that's the level of analysis now. So I think some of that psychological advantage is lost through repetition.
Well, the final was certainly lost when Kepa took that decisive spot kick, much like a goal kick, people have pointed out. Quiveen Kelleher then leading the celebrations for Liverpool. No goalkeeper in their history has won more penalty shootouts than Quiveen. For Liverpool, Sasha, how much does this mean?
I think it keeps the momentum. I know Michael Cox doesn't like classifying 0-0 draws that end in shootout wins as wins, but I do. And I think that's Liverpool's 10th consecutive win. They've conceded maybe 3 or 4 goals in that run. They're certainly building up a momentum that's reminiscent of the end of 2018-2019 season. For this game as well, they were hit with a late change. Thiago got injured in the warm-up, and they've coped with it. I have to say, the game itself, I think, you know, we've been talking about the goalkeeping, but the game itself was curious, because Kelleher himself made 2 really crucial saves in the 5th and the 95th minute. And in between, so at the end and the start of the first half and the second half, Chelsea created excellent chances. I mean, his Mount hitting the post. There was a couple of tactical tweaks. I think when Mount hit the post, he was central for a bit, and I think Liverpool didn't quite react to that. But then between those spells, particularly like for about 20 minutes in the first half, Liverpool had like 85% of the ball. And I thought it was very interesting in the way it was so engrossing, but Liverpool didn't actually create that many clear-cut chances. But then sort of they came in batches, and so did Chelsea's. And there's all these goals that got ruled out as well, very marginally. I thought Van Dijk, I wasn't really sure whether Liverpool goal, I think Liverpool could have stood. Then extra time. I actually thought Havertz's score was okay. But the thing is, the way that the game kept everybody around us gripped, I thought was amazing for a 0-0. And also, if you compare it to the 2-2 draw these teams played out in the league at the start of January, I thought this was much more the impressive game, because at the start of January, I thought Chelsea and Liverpool, after about 65 seconds, looked knackered and looked spent. Whereas here, they kept going. Liverpool got tired in extra time, but I thought they managed the game very well. There was a very few clear-cut chances, apart from the two goals for Chelsea. And I think throughout, I think for Liverpool to keep up this momentum, they got Norwich now coming up in the Cup. They got a few sort of more winnable games in the Champions League and in the league. And I think I think for all of Liverpool fans, the date with City at the start of April is where one would hope Liverpool would come in with this momentum, which they're currently built up.
City, who didn't look insurmountable this weekend, as we'll touch on later on, their game away at Everton. The injury to Thiago, how serious is that? How long is he going to be out for? Any idea yet?
I wasn't sure. No, I found out on kickoff. I was looking at why is he not on the pitch? And
he was in tears, we should say.
He was
to say that, the League Cup final, I thought it was a brilliant game because it both matters a huge amount because it's a cup final and also doesn't define those club seasons, or probably won't define those club seasons, which puts it in this hinterland where brilliant football can happen, I think. But I was amazed to see Thiago crying. I don't think that's necessarily a reflection of how serious the injury is, more just missing the occasion and kind of wanting to contribute. But I think that says an awful lot about the mood and the kind of strength of character within Liverpool squad, that someone like Thiago, who has won plenty, is so desperate to be involved in a League Cup final. That's a really positive angle, I think.
And again, having an injury problem. And about Kelleher, I spoke to him after the match, and he mentioned that he never practiced penalties. I asked that to Fabinho, and he was like, you know what? Yesterday was the first day I saw him practicing that. I've never seen him practicing that. So that was a first. And he said that the way that he scored the penalty was exactly how he practiced over and over on Saturday. So that was his choice. And I remembered actually a talk I had with Alisson like 2 or 3 years ago, and he was like, you know what, we have a young goalkeeper there and he impresses everyone because not only he's very talented, but his personality, you know, he has this big personality. He looks really young, but he has this big personality. And when I saw Kelleher in the penalty shootout, I was like, okay, there's the personality that Alisson mentioned like 3 years ago.
Are they going to win the title, Sasha?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
All right, then.
I'm not even joking.
Right, no, clearly. Of course, it's FA Cup next for Liverpool, as Sasha was mentioning. Liverpool facing Norwich on Wednesday. It's the fourth time those two teams will face each other this season. Liverpool have won the previous three meetings, 3-0, 3-0 and 3-1 just over a week ago. Chelsea, meanwhile, away at Luton that same evening. Luton are in some form. We'll talk more about the prospects of maybe a surprise there and the fifth round in general later on. But next up, we've got some big Premier League talking to do.
So, Mr. Ranić, what's troubling you? Well, we've got a leak in the dressing room, Doctor. Right, and you want to find out who it is? No, I just can't find a good plumber.
Sometimes there's only so much you can do, but with Paddy Power, our offers are watertight. So this weekend, get money back as a free bet if one leg of your 4+4 bet builder lets you down. Paddy Power! Pre-match online bet builder bets only. Min odds 1 to 5 per leg. Max free bet £10 per day. 7-day free bet expiry. Excludes enhanced match odds. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Your Premier League results. The weekend kicked off on Friday with a 2-0 win for Saints against Norwich. Elsewhere, Newcastle continued to climb out of trouble with a 2-0 win at Brentford and moved the Bees closer to it, that game marking the return to football of Christian Eriksen. Villa got a much-needed win at Brighton 2-0. Burnley got a point at Crystal Palace. Everton were narrowly beaten by Man City amid controversy over a Rodri handball later on. West Ham won the Wolves 1-0, and it was 0-0 at Old Trafford for Man United and Watford. Possibly the biggest result of all, though, was the Saturday lunchtime game, which saw Leeds United face Tottenham, lose 4-0, and subsequently part company with much-loved manager Marcelo Bielsa. 3.5 years he and his translator spent at Elland Road, the longest he spent with any club in his career, leading them to their long-awaited promotion to the Premier League in 2020 and a ninth-place finish last season, let's not forget. Well, to give us a bit more perspective on Bielsa and the situation going forward for Leeds, we're joined now by Phil Hay, The Athletic's Leeds correspondent and the man who wrote the book on Bielsa at Leeds, available from all good bookshops. And it was beautiful. And it was, Phil, as you join us now. What a ride this has been.
It's been like no other ride I've experienced writing about a head coach, and probably like no other ride I or Leeds are going to have in the future. It's not to say that another head coach or another manager won't be more successful than Bielsa, won't win trophies, won't take them further up the league. But I think it's the various strands to Bielsa. It's the cultural impact he's had, the aesthetic appeal, the fact that there was so much resistance actually among the fan base to the decision to sack him, even though they'd had the week that they'd had the month that they'd had, even though it was down to a gap of 2 points to the bottom three and clear that they were in a huge amount of trouble. He's earned really unanimous respect. He goes with his reputation 100% intact, and I think vastly enhanced as well. He's always been a head coach who's been, you know, revered by other coaches and you know, somebody who other coaches have learned from and tried to mimic. But I think in bringing to heel a club who, quite honestly, in 2018 felt pretty unmanageable, it could well go down as his biggest achievement, I think.
Mm. Was that your phone pinging, Phil? And
sorry, that was my WhatsApp going. Yes.
No worries. Is it news about who's taking over?
It's just somebody saying that Bielsa is currently at Thorpe Arch saying his goodbyes to his players, which, again, I think gives you some indication of the relationship he's had with the squad and the way he's thought of. You quite often find that when managers go, it becomes fairly bitter and twisted. And there was never any mutiny with Bielsa. I think that's the thing to say, that there was clearly doubt growing, significant doubt growing in the boardroom about whether he was going to be able to get the season in hand. There's no doubt at all as well that the players were starting to struggle tactically and were starting to feel the strain and the pressure of the season. But in terms of a replacement, we're pretty much there already. It's going to be Jesse Marsh, who was the American coach at Salzburg and RB Leipzig for a short time earlier this season. Somebody the club have known about and been in touch with for, or at least have had contact with for a long, long time, primarily because they've had Bielsa on one-year contracts, which has been his wish rather than theirs, and they've always had to have a plan up their sleeve for what they would do if and when he went mid-season or at the end of the season, and Marsh was always somebody who was prominent in their minds. So he needs a work permit, they need to tie up the formalities, but that should get announced in the next 24 hours.
Marsh is available because he was fired by Leipzig after just 21 games in charge, after coming in after Julian Nagelsmann's departure for Bayern Munich. A not altogether successful attempt by Marsh to impose his different tactical ideas on Nagelsmann's team. And how well Marshball, something like that, is going to work at Leeds. This, I guess, is a big question, Phil. People point to Leeds' numbers over the last month or two, and they are extraordinary. A new Premier League record for most goals conceded in a single month, 20, conceding a goal every 19 minutes in recent matches, conceding three or more goals in five consecutive matches in the competition. How much of that is because of Bielsa's approach? How much of that is down to the thinness of the squad and the lack of reinforcements? And therefore, how much of this is going to be resolved by Jesse Marsh coming in and trying to change things?
There are a few factors involved. Injuries have been spoken about all season. But I think more than anything, what we've noticed over the past month, and it's been a problem at times previously under Bielsa, but it's never been endemic, is that the man-marking system, the man-to-man system that he goes with religiously, has started to come apart and has started to weaken fairly drastically. And it started to be seen, I think, by opposition teams as a real way to get at Leeds. And it's been apparent this week, but also going back a little bit further, that has been a big open wound. And it has led to a huge number of goals being conceded. And you're right. I mean, the piece I've written this morning has really said that there will be a lot of talk about Marsh's philosophy and, you know, his pressing, possession-based football, what he did at Salzburg. But the bottom line here and now is the speed and the quality of the impact that he can make. The decision has been made essentially because the board at Leeds felt that with Bielsa in charge for the last 12 games, there was a high risk of them going down. And by changing manager, that kind of lowers the risk and gives them a better chance of staying up. And for what it's worth, I do wonder whether or not they would have done this had Marsh, as you say, not been out of work and available to take right now. But he is going to have to bring the defensive record to heel. He is going to have to make them more potent up front because they haven't been... The attacking stats are just not as good and not in line with where they were last season in the Premier League. And it's going to have to happen quickly. I mean, they probably don't need too many results to stay up, but they certainly need some. And they're going to have to come pretty rapidly.
Phil, lastly, what would be your abiding memory of Marcelo Bielsa at Leeds?
It'd be very hard to pick one. I mean, I very often go back to his first game against Stoke at Elland Road, where there was this kind of magical expectation about what Bielsa might do, but also this lingering scepticism and cynicism that you couldn't help but have at Leeds because of the fact that nobody did false dawns better than Leeds United. And Stoke were an expensively constructed squad that day. They were favourites for the title. They recruited Gary Rowett. A lot of money put into it to putting that project together. And they were absolutely obliterated by the pressing and the passing and movement and the rotations.
Plays an angle ball in, Click is on,
he's
side.
On side. Gets it!
And it's Click! Woohoo! Starts off the Marcelo Bielsa era with a goal inside the first 15 minutes. Oh, Leeds United is celebrating all over the park.
I just remember everybody coming out of the stadium that day and thinking, That was really special. That's some of the best football anybody could remember seeing for years, if not ever, in their lives. And you almost instantly had this sense that this might work. You know, after all the years where it hadn't worked for Leeds and where it had just been meandering, going nowhere fast, this guy might be the real deal. And quite honestly, from that point, they never looked back and have never looked back until it started to go a little bit sour this season.
All right, Phil. Well, hopefully fans of some other club are going to be having revelatory sensations like that over a Bielsa debut soon. For now, many, many thanks for joining us and good luck for the rest of the season.
Thank you.
Phil Hay, who you can hear more from today on the Athletic Football Podcast and probably a bunch of other places as well. Very much a man in demand. All right. Daniel, what's your abiding memory of Marcelo Bielsa?
I think he is the manager, and this sounds slightly trite, but he's the manager that made me really want to watch Leeds United, which for fans of clubs all around the country might be quite a surprising thing. You know, Leeds during the 70s and 80s and to an extent the 90s were not a particularly well-liked club in England, and in certain sections of certain supporters they remain that way. But for the relative neutrals, he made Leeds United appointment television. It's very easy to be kind of nostalgic and feel slightly overly romantic about managers like Bielsa at clubs like Leeds. But ultimately, why do we go and watch football? You know, if it's just about winning trophies, then the reality is that most of those go to one of four or five or six clubs. If it's about kind of grinding out 1-0 wins, then just turn on Teletext or Sky Sports News and find out the result. The reality is you want to be entertained and you want to feel a connection with your club. And Bielsa managed to establish that at a club where it felt like it could almost never happen again. And I will genuinely miss him, even though I have no affinity to Leeds whatsoever.
Well, as a South American, I grew up watching Bielsa's team play. And it's that type of situation where you just tune into his teams, and I am being a romantic. Sorry, I cannot be a romantic when it comes to Bielsa. But we are kind of used to seeing like these big managers come to the Premier League and be successful and achieve things. But it was much more than that in this case, because it was the link. It was like a marriage when things just they just look right. There's the identification, and you see Klopp in Liverpool, for example. It's not just a matter of Klopp being such a big manager. It's that link, it's that bond. And with Bielsa, it was always like that. And you can question his choices, especially in the past few matches. Why didn't he play more defensively? And of course, it's actually obvious and kind of easy to say that. So what if he tried being more defensive, and after three seasons of Leeds playing like that, they wouldn't instantly adapt? Then he would get sacked anyway, but he would also have dealt with the fact that he dropped his principles, which he never did in his whole career. So to what extent should we really expect him to go more defensively, you know, to play in a different way? He didn't do that during his whole career. He is very committed to that, to the extent that Leeds were struggling, and there he's still, you can agree or disagree, but there is some level of comfort to know that a manager is that committed.
Absolutely. Some level of comfort if you are a neutral or a fan of the opposition. If he was in charge of, say, Corinthians, Natalie, and they were like hemorrhaging goals.
I would be very happy.
Yeah? Even if you went down with him.
I know what you mean, James. Right. And I understand the point. I said there's some level of comfort in that. No, but really, because that's what you get with Bielsa. And he would be very happy in Corinthians.
Just on a personal level, one of the things I really liked about Bielsa, and it's become a kind of my broken record, is he always took responsibility himself. He never blamed referees. He never called out his players. He always said, if the players aren't playing well, it's because I've got something wrong, either in training or in my tactical plan. Ultimately, I suspect that deflects criticism, and whether that's deliberate or otherwise, I don't know. But it was just so refreshing to hear a man constantly asked about VAR, constantly asked about refereeing decisions, and he kind of said, well, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about what I did wrong. That is something that's pretty rare now in football.
And I think maybe this is the reason, because I think of sort of Bielsa as being quite a peculiar man. He's different, I think, I think it's easy to see that he's different from so many, but perhaps because he takes so much responsibility, maybe this is where the loyalty and appreciation of his players comes into it. And I think one thing that Phil raised there about man-marking, perhaps, maybe this is where his philosophy maybe has outlived itself due to maybe higher levels of analysis and preparation. I mean, 10 years ago, they could play, you know, Man United in the Champions League and obliterate them with this man-marking, with this high intensity. But now, perhaps, the players on the opposition are becoming more sophisticated. So, for example, I think if you take the Spurs game, the whole thing with Harry Kane dropping deep, I think absolutely destroyed Leeds, because once players try to follow, things break down further upfield. There is not enough actual midfielders there to obstruct Kane, and Kane had a field day. And I, you know, thinking of Conte, he would have seen that particular weakness. So I think maybe analysis is moving on. Maybe he has to look at his man-marking system. I don't think it's necessarily maybe the mentality and the approach has to change, but perhaps certain tactical things. Or maybe he might just say, look, I've done football for 30 years. Maybe it's enough.
Spurs, also managed by a man who never deflects responsibility or blames other people. Antonio Conte certainly enjoyed the occasion. Four goals, the first wing-back-to-wing-back affair. Matt Doherty with his first ever goal for the club. Kulusevski looking great. That's his second goal in three Premier League starts. You mentioned Harry Kane dropping deep, though, Sasha. Oh my word. His pass for Son's goal. We all love Bielsa, but I think we all love watching Harry Kane ping that ball to Son Heung-min.
It was a masterclass, especially on second half. And not only the vision, the things he sees on the pitch, but the execution is spot on every time. It's ridiculous how his vision is ahead of everyone else, and this bizarre understanding he has with Son is incredible. And I like Conte after the match saying, "My team is not soft." And it's true, because you expect more resilience from a Conte team, definitely. So I like how explicit he is with that, because Spurs were not soft. 27 minutes on and they were 3-0 up. So it was a great performance, yeah.
Leeds are now 2 points from the drop. Brentford are only 1 point above them, also in a mess, and have played a game more. Below Leeds, meanwhile, and just 1 point from Burnley in the bottom three now, are Everton, although like Burnley, they have games in hand to Frank Lampard's side. Duncan on Thursday, blowing a lot of people's minds by saying he thinks the bottom three are actually all going to stay up, Burnley, Watford and Norwich, with Brentford, Leeds and Everton going down in their place. What do you think about that?
Can I unblow their minds by saying I disagree with them?
I think so do I.
Yeah,
I think
it's nonsense, clearly.
I think Norwich will go. They've got 12 points for 15 games under Dean Smith, which is an improvement, but not enough of one. I think Watford will go because their away form, or their defensive record away from home, has improved drastically under Roy Hodgson, but they've taken 3 points from their last 30 available at Vicarage Road, and you need home form if you're going to stay in the Premier League, so I think they go. And I think Brentford are the other ones. I think, you know, this weekend we've seen a kind of mini dynastical manager who pulled a club up into the Premier League against all expectation get sacked. And I think if Thomas Frank loses to Norwich next weekend, he might be the next one.
Crikey.
Brentford are in, I think they're in absolutely no form. I know they went down to 10 men, but that should provoke some resilience. I mean, they allowed Newcastle to have 26 shots, which is Newcastle don't have 26 shots and Brentford aren't meant to face 26 shots. That to me suggests something is really, really wrong. And yeah, that, I mean, if they lose to Norwich next weekend, that'll be 1 point from a possible 27 in the league. That's just not good enough. They've played, you know, look at the games they've played recently, and they're just rolling over and having their tummies tickled. And that's exactly what we don't expect from Thomas Frank's Brentford.
We have to wait and see if and what kind of impact Eriksen can have in that. Actually, in a moral way and confidence. And of course, we saw some glimpses of how much he can contribute to the team technically. Of course, he's not a miracle worker and his situation is very peculiar, but he will always be very talented and maybe can lift the mood a little bit. Of course, the circumstances against Newcastle weren't ideal because they Josh De Silva got sent off with 11 minutes, but we'll see. Maybe it's an element that can make a difference for Brentford.
Mm. As a resident Brentford fan, it quite pains me to see the deterioration. I mean, I went to see Arsenal Brentford the other week, and very static, clearly lacking confidence. Raya has come in, perhaps in a team that's losing confidence while he's still quite a little bit rusty. And the way Arsenal kind of played around them was quite sort of painful to watch, because they... Basically, I think this is what they've hit now. They just can't play anymore. I think it was a bit unfair on Eriksen to come in into a 10-man side. But yeah, the way they got trampled by Newcastle, I think these games against Newcastle, Norwich, and then they have Burnley. Yeah, they need now, I think, to get at least 3-4 points from those next two. And it's almost so much pressure on Eriksen, but it's also pressure on Frank. Frank, tactically, I think, has to change.
Norwich, who this weekend were beaten at Southampton 2-0. That's three defeats in a row for them. Burnley, meantime, roll on. They've only had one defeat in their last seven. They drew at Palace, although they only had one shot on target in that game. If Burnley avoid defeat at home to Leicester on Tuesday, listener, in one of the games they've got in hand, they'll be out of the bottom three. And guess who'll be in it? Everton. Unthinkable. And yet, there you go. After their 1-0 defeat at home to Man City, tea time on Saturday, that's the situation. They've lost now their last 10 meetings with Man City. But should they have lost this one? He strokes chin. Dan, let's come to you, because this is a refereeing controversy. It's very much your
wheelhouse. It is. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it was a handball. I mean, they said there wasn't enough evidence to be sure that it didn't hit the sleeve rather than below the sleeve, and that is now the new line, which was brought into as this. Well, now you've got the certainty you wanted, and you think, how is that any more certain if we're looking at how long people's short sleeves are? And I'm surprised any player wears a long sleeve shirt now, because it kind of makes me think you're more likely to give away a handball. But yeah, I think they should have had a penalty for it. I think City were were the better team in the second half, but I was really impressed with how Everton played in the first half. I worried that Lampard was just kind of going to make this sort of free-form Everton roller coaster and hope they just won enough games to stay up, which I still think they probably will do. But there was at least some kind of tactical discipline here against City, and they need to take that forward, because there's a psychological thing when a team falls in the relegation zone. They know that trouble is around the corner, and they can all see the table every week. But when you fall into that relegation zone, it does cause a kind of panic that says, hang on, now we're the ones that need to get out of here. And they aren't playing very well at the moment. So, yeah, this was a bit of a free hit. They've got some decent home games coming up, Everton, but I think they'll be fine. I do think they'll be fine.
Well, Frank, afterwards, I have a three-year-old daughter at home who could tell you that was a penalty. A mistake is when you've done something wrong and don't have time to think about it. They had 2 minutes to digest the handball. It is incompetent at best. I think the at best is pretty interesting at the end of that.
I absolutely hate that. Yeah, I mean, I wrote.
Well, you can understand him being upset, but
yeah, I can. But I wrote a column last Friday about this kind of creeping conspiratorial theory element to football.
They got you too, hard
supporters. Yeah, exactly. The man made me write it. But yes, it doesn't help when managers say competence at best, because the implication is that the alternative is that there's some form of corruption, and you'd be surprised how many fans buy into that sort of stuff.
I agree with Daniel when he says that in the end I think Everton will stay up, because I think if you look at the squad, the talent of the players, I think it's going to make a difference in the end. Plus, you see something's changing. You see that they show more organization, they show more energy. I think they really changed their body language and the way that they behave on the pitch. They defended really well on first half. It was definitely a very harsh result on Everton. And it was Man City pulling a Man City again, because they're just finding ways of winning, even though there's controversy involved, but it's Man City.
Even though they're not going to win the title. Well, City next up will be travelling to Championship Peterborough in the FA Cup fifth round on Tuesday. Everton, meanwhile, host Boreham Wood. Boreham Wood, who are yet to concede a single goal in the competition this season. Boreham Wood, who were 1-0 winners over Eastleigh to stay third in the National League on Saturday. Could they spring a huge cup upset? We'll be talking about that and the rest of the FA Cup fifth round next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is excellent news for Everton fans when they make their Lampardian transition from serious to funny to serious once again. Pre-match bet builders only. Get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Yep, the FA Cup's traditional. What the f***? They scheduled it in the middle of the week. Fifth round is with us. All games are going to be televised in some way or another. A little bit of red button involved for Palace, Stoke and Saints West Ham, but fair enough. Tuesday, you've got Peterborough hosting Man City. Palace, Stoke, Borough, who put out Man United, will take on Tottenham. Then on Wednesday, it's Luton, Chelsea. Blues beat Luton 3-1 in this competition, round four, last season. That was at Stamford Bridge, though. And also that night, there's Saints West Ham and Liverpool, Norwich. And then on Thursday, Everton are up against the lowest-ranked team, Boreham Wood. And on Monday, you've got Nottingham Forest, Huddersfield. Why is that on Monday, Daniel Storey?
That's a very good question.
All right, then.
There is a reason for it, though. I'll find out. I'll answer that after we've chatted.
In the meantime, clearly the biggest story of any of that is Boreham Wood. Non-league Boreham Wood, the lowest-ranked team, etc. and so on. The club whose chairman had to mortgage his house just to get them through the pandemic. The only team yet to concede a single goal in this competition this season. Crikey. And given that they're playing an Everton team whose concerns are probably elsewhere on their Premier League survival, might we see an almighty upset here? Well, one man who's been watching Boreham Wood, the Wood, all season is BT Sports' Adam Summerton. What does he think? Adam!
Hello, everyone. How are you?
Adam, what do you think?
I think that they're a horrible team to play against, and that's how they want it to be. They just concede so few goals, the best defensive record in the National League. They're very stubborn, as you've just mentioned. They haven't conceded a single goal in their FA Cup run this season, which, when you look at some of the sides that they've played, is quite the feat, really. I mean, they've only conceded 17 goals. Well, they're just so well organised. And I think that one thing that hasn't really been discussed that much, actually, about this run and the success that they're having this season is that they're doing it whilst contending with some injuries to some important defenders, actually. They're without Fifield at the moment. They're without Elisami, both of whom would start if they were fit. Mafuta, who plays in central midfield, has been unavailable recently as well. They lost, in my opinion, the best striker outside of the Football League at the end of last season when Shimanga left the club for Stockport. They lost their goalkeeper at the start of this earlier on in the season, Ashmore as well, to injury. So they lost the spine of the side. So they're right in contention to win the National League. And they're also managing to get to the last 16 of the FA Cup with some significant injuries. I just hope, James, that they have Kane Smith fit for this game, because he and Mendy, the two wing-backs, are fundamental to the way that they play. Kane Smith is a big Everton fan. You'll have seen him with his Hibbert shirt on the pitch after they beat Bournemouth. He's missed the last two games with an injury, and it would be such a shame if he wasn't fit. Mendy on the other flank, a year ago, he was getting up at six every morning to work on a building site. Before that, he was a cleaner. Before that, he separated rubbish for a waste management firm. His last job before he went full-time with football was building houses in Kensington. And he once upon a time was in Atletico Madrid's youth system. So he's had quite a journey. Wow. But those two really are so important to the way that they play in terms of the creativity that they can provide as well. But yeah, they just want to be as horrible to play against as they possibly can be. And it's worked a treat for them this season.
It's extraordinary. And against an Everton team who are not exactly prolific in terms of scoring goals, especially with Dominic Calvert-Lewin ruled out for even longer, we hear now. What do you think? What are the chances? What percentage chance do you think they would have of taking it even to maybe penalties?
Well, it's a small chance because, you know, they're playing Premier League opposition and we can't underestimate that. You know, I remember the run that Lincoln City had when they were a National League side, when they ended up at the Emirates against Arsenal. They put up actually quite a valiant fight in the first half, but eventually were rather overwhelmed. And you could see a similar scenario happening here. But, you know, they went into the Bournemouth game clearly as massive underdogs. I remember Luke Garrard talking about Scott Parker's clobber and how he wanted some of his clobber, he said. He's the best dressed man in the Football League or something, I think he was saying. So found that quite amusing going into that game. But Luke Garrard's a great story in himself. I mean, I think he's been at the club around a decade now. He was the youngest manager in the football league, in the top five leagues when he got the job. I think he might still be actually the same age as Wayne Rooney, 36. I can't believe that he's not been picked off yet by a Football League club. He's shown incredible loyalty to both the chairman, Danny Hunter, who, by the way, is a big Chelsea fan, Danny Hunter. So he'll be looking forward to coming up against Frank Lampard. But he's a really good man manager, Luke Garrard. And when you read interviews and when you listen to interviews with the Boreham Wood players, his man management goes a long way. He's got them believing in doing the impossible. And I think it was looked almost impossible to win at Bournemouth, you know, against AFC Wimbledon. That was clearly a difficult task as well. So the odds are stacked against them, but I wouldn't rule it out.
Oh, there you go. That's coming up on Thursday night. If they get through that, imagine if they got Forest. The Wood, Forest. Have you any word on why that fixture's on Monday?
I think it's simply just that the FA wanted every game to be on TV. And Forrester's championship game against Sheffield United is on Friday night. So Forrester playing Friday, Monday, because they couldn't play Wednesday, Friday.
Okay. It's that exciting. Okay, good.
So the answer is do not ask me that question.
So Thursday, clearly that one's going to penalties. That's going to be extraordinary drama. What else? I mean, where might other upsets come? Any other fixtures you're excited by? Chelsea at Kenilworth Road, a Luton team who've won six of the last seven in all competitions.
Yeah, Luton-Chelsea is the kind of likely banana skin, I suppose. Middlesbrough-Tottenham feels like that's a very noughties cup fixture to me, Middlesbrough-Tottenham. But yeah, I think Luton-Chelsea would be the one. I don't know if, for anyone who hasn't been to in the away end at Luton at Kenilworth Road, you literally walk through a row of houses and past someone's back garden to get up there. So it feels very kind of old school FA Cup. So yeah, that's the tie of the round for me.
Lovely stuff. Okay. Well, we've still got the top four race and that to have a quick check on in the Premier League before we get on to, for many people, the highlight of today's show, and that is the Intertotally Cup Match 4 featuring Sasha Gurionov. That's coming up. But next up, Premier League top four.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Premier League top four. Man United are still fourth, with West Ham fifth, 2 points behind Ralph Rangnick's side. Both those teams, though, have played 27 matches. Arsenal, who are level with West Ham, have 3 games in hand. Crikey. Spurs, 5 points off the top four, have 2 games in hand. Wolves, beaten, of course, by West Ham this weekend and beaten last Thursday by Arsenal, and are 7 points off the Champions League places. They do have 1 game in hand, but that's obviously not as much as Spurs and Arsenal. Whew. Well, West Ham, Wolves. Thomas Souček, the only goal of the game, on his birthday with his granddad watching live. That's the first time he'd seen him in action. That's a lovely story. So that's nice. But I kind of feel like we want to talk about Man United Watford. I know we talk about Man United a lot. Daniel, you saw them away at Atletico Madrid looking excellent in the Champions League. Is that right?
No.
Not looking excellent in the Champions
League. No, I don't think they were. I think they were kind of rotten for the first hour. They couldn't pass in their own half. And against
Watford,
that's
right. Now, yeah.
Against Watford, they were able to pass in their own half, but they couldn't finish the chances or find the final ball.
How did it finish goalless?
It finished goalless because Cristiano Ronaldo is kind of unfit for purpose at the moment. I think in his last 10 games, he's had 36 shots and scored once. Which is, if you're not going to press and you're not going to create and you're not really going to move much, the one thing it would be nice if you could do is finish. But
absolutely. I mean, fans of his, oh, mum, kind of the world is so unfair pout, had a really vintage time of it watching this game. There was one moment in particular where he was just stood disinterestedly while the action was going on around him in the Watford box. And I think the ball even bounces off him as he stood hands on hip or whatever. Yeah, remarkable. I mean, it's a shame to see it go that way, but in other ways it's, you know, not. Natalie,
how can you have the likes of Ronaldo, Bruno Fernandes, Sancho on the second half and still don't score against Watford? Like, because it was such a dominant performance from Man United, and like they couldn't take the good moments they had on the match. And you drop points against Watford when you're facing next Manchester City, Tottenham and Liverpool. Like, that is just bad timing. That's terrible timing. You need the 3 points there because they have a big month ahead of them now.
One other game which doesn't really fit into any of those things, except to say well done Aston Villa because they got a much needed win. 2-0 away at Brighton. They actually beat Brighton, of course, in the reverse fixture 2-0 as well. Ollie Watkins on the score sheet both times, but very little in between. Brighton now on their worst losing streak of the season. That's 3 defeats in a row. The Seagulls only had 1 shot on target. Crikey. Any thoughts on that? Or do you want to just get on to the Intertotally Cup. Sasha
quiz,
does.
Quiz.
All right.
Yeah, I'll get onto that. I'm going to regret a few celebratory pints after the game yesterday because my brain doesn't seem to function anymore.
I wondered why you were sweating so much all show.
All right, then. After this, Intertotally Cup, match 4.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
It's the Intertotally Cup, everybody. All right, this is match 4 of this season's tournament. And yes, it's been a cracker so far. We open with Duncan Alexander beating Alvaro Romeo 4-0. Then Dom Fifield downed Tom Williams 4-1. Thursday, Benji Laniado had a narrow Hail Mary 3-2 win over Adrian Clark. Now, two more contestants enter our kind of big Budokan ring thing.
Up first, he's a Liverpool fan who spends his weekends rushing between at least three games. From the east, via the northwest, it's our friend, Sasha Gorina.
Sasha, so nice of you to join us for the Intertotally Cup. Have you come far?
No, I've just come from the pod.
Right.
So, yeah, it's. I wish I was in a slightly fitter fighting state, but I'm going to give it my best go.
All right. Nice jaunty music. What was that?
That was Kino, Victor Tsoi. They were late sort of 90s band, and they were quite sort of groundbreaking back in the USSR. Unfortunately, the lead singer got killed in a car crash in August 1991, but they remain like one of those iconic bands, iconic voices of sort of late 80s Soviet Union.
Very much like yourself, Sasha.
Thanks.
Sasha, who placed fourth last year in our special third-fourth playoff to Julien Laurens. Let's find out who Sasha's going to be facing in the first round this season.
And his opponent. She's a recent nominee at the Sports Journalism Awards for her prodigious work ethic, and this QPR fan's probably got another podcast to do as soon as she finishes this one. Representing South Africa Road, it's Flo Lloyd Hughes.
All right, Flo Lloyd Hughes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Bit of pig bag there, just going to wake everybody up. Very nice.
Yeah, wanted to make sure everyone was alert and ready to quiz.
Nice. I know you grew up watching the Intertotally years on Sky, Flo. Now here you are about to actually take part. How does that feel?
It feels incredible. It really does. I never thought I would be able to fulfill my lifelong dream. So never stop dreaming, kids, is what I'll say.
That's very beautifully put. All right. How do you feel about drawing Sasha?
Not great, to be honest. I didn't actually know that he came fourth last year, so that intro definitely freaked me out a little bit. So here we go.
All right.
If anything, I should have come third, but I had to let Jules win because Jules actually forced the playoff, which wasn't in the original plan.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of you, Sasha. Maybe you'll feel magnanimous with Flo as well. Whoever does go through to the quarterfinals will win £10 from Paddy Power to place on a bet of your choice, with the winnings going to charity. What charity are you picking, Sasha?
International Red Cross.
Okay, excellent. And what is your wager?
That Boreham Woods would be level with Everton at 90 minutes.
Interesting. Well, best of luck with that from all sorts of perspectives. And what about you, Flo? What's your charity?
My charity is Insight NGO, which is a charity supporting LGBTQ youth in Ukraine.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Okay. And what's your bet?
My bet is for QPR to get promoted, which, for the record, I don't actually necessarily want that much. I think it would be a terrible idea and we would lose most of our games in the Premier League. But I think it's probably still semi-realistic. So that is my bet.
Crikey. Wow. Let's see. Sasha, you're up first. Here come your questions. Question one, Sasha. Which team did Spain dramatically beat 5-3 after extra time in their round of 16 game at Euro 2020?
Croatia.
Correct. Question two. At which Brazilian club did Ronaldinho start his career?
Botafogo.
Is incorrect. Natalie, who is it?
Grêmio.
Oh, Grêmio.
Question three, Sasha. This is the career path of which championship player? Sunderland, Newcastle, Nottingham Forest.
Current or past?
Current. Sunderland, then Newcastle, and now Nottingham Forest.
Sunderland, Newcastle.
Gonna have to hurry you,
no,
Sasha.
No.
Daniel?
It's the ginger in the ester, Jack Colback.
Indeed it is.
That's right. A tough question, by the
way. Yeah, I wasn't going to get that.
All right, okay. So 1 for 3 so far. Question 4. Against which team was Arsene Wenger's final Premier League match as Arsenal manager?
Oh, come on.
That's not a question for a hangover, is it?
No. Last.
Arsene Wenger bowing out.
Stoke.
Ooh, I can see where you're going, but it was actually Huddersfield.
Ah!
All right, question 5. To double your score, Sasha. In which country did Nicolas Anelka finish his playing career?
Qatar.
Is incorrect, Sasha. It's India.
That is... You've been stitched up there, Sasha. Wow. Well, we haven't heard Flo's questions yet, so...
Yep. This has been, true. You know, I've been listening to the previous games. This has been a tough year.
It has been a tough year. We make no excuses for that.
For everyone.
For everybody. Wow. Anelka probably should have got. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one. And especially because he's been around so much. 1 out of 5. I mean, it has been a tough year. And 2 of our previous contestants you would beat with that score. So let's just see if Flo can beat it as we ask her question 1. Flo, which team did Spain beat on penalties in the quarterfinals of Euro 2020?
Switzerland?
Is correct. You're level now with Sash. This to go through to the quarterfinals. Question 2. At which Argentinian club did Sergio Aguero start his career?
Oof.
You can have a pop at this, surely.
River Plate?
Is incorrect. It was Independiente. Question 3, then. Still plenty of chances to take this. This is the career path of which current championship player? Guingamp, Leicester City, Standard Liège, Brighton, Fulham. Guingamp, Leicester City,
Standard... Anthony Knockhart?
Is correct, Flo Lloyd-Hughes, and you are in the quarterfinals.
I really did not see that coming, I'll tell you that much.
Really? Let's see how you would have done.
Yeah, they paid $12 million for him.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Knockout, and that's exactly what you've done to Sasha Gurionov. Nice.
Nicely done.
Let's just see the next, what kind of final score you would come up with. Question 4. Against which team was Sir Alex Ferguson's final Premier League match as Man United manager?
Oh.
See, Sasha's thinking, I would have got. Yeah.
That's an easier question than Wenger's.
Is that an easier question?
Mm-hmm, it is.
Yeah. All right. Flo, what'd you got?
Yeah. I think score.
I'm trying to work out who... I feel like it might be being a team that was going to be relegated or relegated around that time. So that's why I'm trying to do the math. But I'm going to go with Stoke City.
Hey, everyone likes saying Stoke for that, but no, it's West Brom.
Yeah.
All right, and here's a really nice question. Question 5. In which country did Robbie Fowler finish his playing career?
Australia? India.
Wrong.
Thailand.
Wrong. Thailand. Yes, oh. Sasha. Yeah.
Moana, you would have got.
Sasha's not reacting well at this moment.
Damn. He's completely lost it.
The incredible soak, Sasha Gurinov.
Not coming back next season. This is so unfair. And well played, Flo.
Well played, Flo.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well played, Flo.
There's nothing better than a quiz where the winner apologises for winning.
We're all nice people here, and the values of sportsmanship I think are at the heart of what the Intertoto Cup represents. But how do you feel about going through to the quarterfinal, where checks notes you will be facing... Ooh, crikey, you're going to be either facing Daniel or Michael Cox.
That's very generous of you to say it in that way, James.
I feel like the fact that I got through on getting two questions right doesn't fill me with a whole ton of optimism and confidence going forward. But you know what? Anything can happen. It's the Intertotally quiz or whatever it's called. So you know, we can't predict anything here.
It's cup quizzing. Literally anything can happen. And I should mention, though, that throughout that, Daniel was nodding convincingly to every question pretty much that I answered. So it looks like he's in great shape ahead of that absolutely huge first round.
If you could
matchup.
Only ask me exactly the same five questions as one of these two got, I'll be fine.
Oh, how many did you get out of 10 then, Daniel?
Seven or eight, maybe.
Fighting talk, huh?
Hello. Yeah. All right. Yeah,
but it's Michael, isn't it?
So are you listening, Michael Cox? Are you? All right. Flo, listen, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you in round two, if not before. But in the meantime, congratulations.
See you there.
Felicitations, Florence. You're through to the next round of the Intertotally Cup. And if you want to follow Flo's bet that QPR will be promoted back to the Premier League this season, you'll get odds of 7-1 at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. And please gamble responsibly.
Excellent. Well, that brings us to the end of today's Totally Football Show. Sasha, thank you so much for being part of it. Sorry, though. You know, the breaks went the way they did on that Intertotally.
This is football. This is football.
It is, isn't it? All right. Lovely to see you. Lovely to see you too, Natalie and Daniel. Thank you for being with us.
Can you just call me just so I can see the game faces on Daniel and Michael's?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no, that's going to be so entertaining. I'm already excited about it.
All right. Michael's game face is pretty impassive.
I was going to say.
Yeah, he just sits there. It's calmly.
It's more the voice that will knock me out of the competition than the face, to be honest.
Well, do we know when that's coming up, producer Charlie? Not yet, no. It's just you're just going to have to listen to every episode, listener, to you know, to make sure you catch it. But still to come in the first round, we have Michael Cox against Daniel Story, the Horncastle Eccleshare duel, which is very keenly anticipated, and Matt Davis Adams against Julian Laurent. So that's going to be huge. Yeah. All right. One of those coming up on Thursday. For now, that brings us to the end of the show. Thanks, as I mentioned, to everybody. And most of all, well, producer Charlie and you, listener, will be back on Thursday. Do hope you'll be with us then. Cheerio.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.